Welcome to Your Course Church.
.ca.
Hello, podcast listeners. It's Nina Sherman-Drenth coming to you with a midweek recording. Reason for that is, and some of you will know this if you've been at church in person the last couple of Sundays, I preached the last two. And with both of them, there were difficulties that made it such that we weren't able to record in person. And so I figured that I would come on here and actually preach both of my sermons in one podcast, in one recording. And reason for that is I think that it will be really interesting to compare and contrast or sort of listen to both of these messages one after the other. So if you have a good amount of time and you're able to listen to them both in the same shot, I think that you'll experience there to be some pretty good synergy between the good news that's highlighted in both of the verses both of the passages that I'm going to be reflecting on. We will maybe leave a timestamp in the description or something like that, so that if you want to skip to the second sermon, you're welcome to do that. But like I said, I figured I would put them both in one message so that we can enjoy noticing the common thread that exists actually through the whole of Scripture and especially in these two passages. And in fact, there's actually synergy between the message that I'd like to give today and the last message that is here on the podcast, one that Kevin preached a number of weeks ago now, where he talked about just kind of how hard it is to be human in this time in history. He brought up some sobering realities about how disconnected we are from one another. We hardly even know our neighbors. We hardly even know each other. It's so hard to have a conversation in which we get vulnerable enough to really connect and really know each other. We're disconnected from the land. We're disconnected from where our food comes from. But even more than that, we're disconnected from our own backyards, from our own front lawns, from how the water flows in those places, from how the energy exists in the soil that is even as close to us as our own backyard. We hardly know the land. And we're disconnected ultimately from God. Many of us hardly even know what the word God means. We don't have a common understanding in our society of who this God, this source, this ultimate reality is. And it makes it hard to even converse with one another and come to conclusions about who it is that we are here for and what we exist to do because of that. We're disconnected from God. Philosophers have been noticing this increasing disconnection that we have with ourselves and our land and our spirits, our spirituality, and some have given a name to this time in history and what they see it as being. They call it the post-enlightenment disenchantment. Disenchantment. We are disenchanted. And I think that's a perfect word for it. We see the people around us as unenchanted. Are we even curious about them? You know what I mean? We see the land as disenchanted. And instead of it being a living, breathing reality that upholds and sustains us, it's just become this supermarket of natural resources that we can mine and harvest and cut down and turn into something for our benefit. We see God not as this beautiful creator that we ought to get to know simply because of how good that God is. Instead, we maybe see God as an antiquated idea. Maybe we see God as a vending machine for whatever wants we have at any given time. Maybe God's become for us just a pawn in whatever political game we want to play. God has been unwilded, disenchanted, just like our lawns, our conversations, our lives. This is a disenchanted age. And I got thinking about how it's easy in a time like this to simply believe that humanity is, well, damned. In a very real sense of the word, that things are horrible, that they won't get better, that we've proven ourselves rotten to the core. In fact, I know people who believe, and I don't blame them, that we as humanity are simply an invasive species on an earth that we have ransacked and destroyed, that there's nothing good about us, even ecologically. And there is so much evidence to that belief. And yet, despite all that evidence, what's so interesting, what's so compelling, what's so fascinating is that Christians, people who follow the way of Jesus Christ, have actually always believed something alternative. Something radical, something even scandalous in an age of cynicism and despair. As Christians, we believe that human beings are made in the image of the divine being, the Creator God. Which is so crazy. But there's this prayer that got me thinking about this that stopped me in my tracks this week. It's a prayer from the Iona community in Scotland. And it says this. It says, "We affirm God's goodness at the heart of humanity, planted more deeply than all that is wrong." We affirm God's goodness at the heart of humanity, planted more deeply than all that is wrong. I read that this week, and then I looked out at encampments beside shiny multi-story condos. I looked out at how we treat each other in political discourse. I looked up at skies, which right now in Ontario are hazy from smoke, from wildfires that burn while the climate changes at our fault and expense. And I would not look away from all that. But I would also like to affirm that goodness of humanity. And so I've been getting curious, and I've been starting to wonder, and this is what we'll spend some time thinking about together today. What is that goodness at the heart of humanity? And how do we re-access it in an age when humanity is so disconnected from all that makes us human? And so we're actually going to go all the way to the beginning, all the way to the source, to think a little bit about, firstly, just how we fit into the larger created order that exists on this planet. What God, our source, our ultimate reality, called us as the first humans, and then what we're told to do. What we're told to keep busy with in order to be as human as we possibly can. And hopefully in doing so, what I hope we'll carve out is a bit of a roadmap for our time that takes us back to that original goodness that we'd really like to believe is planted more deeply than all that is not right with us. So I'm going to read Genesis 1 and the first few verses of Genesis 2. And you're welcome to just listen and take this in. This is in a slightly different translation than you may be used to. It's a translation put together by the Priests for Equality of the Jesuit Order. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. But the earth became chaos and emptiness, and darkness came over the face of the deep, yet the Spirit of God was brooding over the surface of the waters. And then God said, "Light be," and light was. God saw that light was good, and God separated light from darkness. God called the light day and the darkness night. Evening came and morning followed the first day. Then God said, "Now make an expanse between the waters. Separate water from water." So it was. God made the expanse and separated the water above the expanse from the water below it. God called the expanse sky. Evening came and morning followed the second day. Then God said, "Waters under the sky be gathered into one place. Dry ground appear." So it was. God called the dry ground earth and the gathering of the waters sea, and God saw that it was good. And then God said, "Earth, produce vegetation, plants that scatter their own seeds, and every kind of fruit tree that bears fruit with its own seed in it." So it was. The earth brought forth every kind of plant that bears seed and every kind of fruit tree on earth that bears fruit with the seed in it. And God saw that it was good. Evening came and morning followed the third day. Then God said, "Now let there be lights in the expanse of the sky. Separate day from night. Let them mark the signs and seasons, days and years, and serve as luminaries in the sky, shedding light on the earth." So it was. God made the two great lights, the greater one to illuminate the day and a lesser to illuminate the night. Then God made the stars as well, placing them in the expanse of the sky to shed light on the earth, to govern both day and night and separate light from darkness. And God saw that this was good. Evening came and morning followed the fourth day. God then said, "Waters, swarm with an abundance of living beings. Birds, fly above the earth with the open expanse of the sky." And so it was. God created great sea monsters and all sorts of swimming creatures with which the waters are filled, and all kinds of birds. God saw that this was good and blessed them, saying, "Bear fruit, increase your numbers, and fill the waters of the seas. Birds, abound on the earth." Evening came and morning followed the fifth day. Then God said, "Earth, bring forth all kinds of living soul, cattle, things that crawl, and wild animals of all kinds." And so it was. God made all kinds of wild animals and cattle and everything that crawls on the ground, and God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let us make humankind in our image, to be like us. Let them be stewards of the fish in the sea, the birds of the air, and the cattle, the wild animals, and everything that crawls on the ground." Humankind was created as God's reflection. In the divine image, God created them. Female and male, God made them. God blessed them and said, "Bear fruit. Increase your numbers and fill the earth and be responsible for it. Watch over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and all the living things on the earth." God then told them, "Look, I give you every seed-bearing plant in the face of the earth and every tree whose fruit carries its seed inside itself. They will be your food. And to all the animals of the earth and the birds of the air and things that crawl on the ground, everything that has a living soul in it, I give all the green plants for food." So it was. God looked at all of this creation and proclaimed that it was good, very good. Evening came and morning followed the sixth day. Thus the heavens and the earth and all their array were completed. On the seventh day, God had finished all the work of creation. So on the seventh day, God rested. God blessed the seventh day and called it sacred, holy, because on it God rested from the work of creation. These are the generations of the heavens and the earth when they were created. At the time when Yahweh made the heavens and the earth, there was still no wild bush on the earth, nor had any wild plant sprung up. for Yahweh had not yet sent rain to the earth, and there was no human being to till the soil. Instead, a flow of water would well up from the ground and irrigate the soil. So Yahweh fashioned an earth creature out of the clay of the earth and blew into its nostrils the breath of life, and the earth creature became a living being. Yahweh planted a garden to the east in Eden, land of pleasure, and placed on it the earth creature that had been made. And then Yahweh caused every kind of tree enticing to look at and good to eat to spring from the soil. In the center of the garden was a tree of life, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Amen. So this is a long passage, but what it is, in fact, is two poems that take us through 7 days. On the first 6 days, Creator God makes a whole bunch of stuff. He makes water and seas, and he makes ground and plants. He makes a sky. He makes animals. And on the sixth day, the Creator makes humanity. Each day, after making all the things that he made, he would take a moment to look at all that he would make, and he would call it good. But on the sixth day, after making humanity, he doesn't just call the creation good. He instead calls it very good. So this is a really exciting day. The sixth day is, in fact, often treated in our Christian rhetoric as something of a kind of climax of the story. The most exciting part, the part that we wait for, the moment when something is made in the image of God. I mean, that's a really big deal. And then there's this sort of seventh day that we don't really kind of know what to do with. It's a denouement that's just sort of tacked on. God rests, but we don't really know why it's there. But as I've studied this passage, I've started to get the sense that thinking of the sixth day as a climax is sort of an anthropocentric reading of the text, in the sense that it puts humans on far too high a pedestal. Because there is still this funny seventh day. And I'll never forget the day that I realized that in chapter 2, verse 2, when it's talking about the seventh day, it says it explicitly. It says that on the seventh day, God finished, completed, and perfected the work he was doing. On the seventh day, not the sixth day. So humans were not the last word. Humans, in fact, don't complete creation. On the sixth day, something was still missing. We weren't quite important enough to be the finishers, the completers, the perfectors. What finishes creation in the first of the two creation poems, what makes creation what it is, what makes it something that's called not just good and not just very good, but on the seventh day, it's called holy. It's the first ever instance of the word holy. And what makes that such is Sabbath rest. Sabbath rest. Seventh day rest. This creation poem is a story about a God who rests. A God who doesn't meddle, doesn't toil or worry, doesn't go, go, go. Instead, he practices presence. He practices attention. He practices spaciousness and calls all that holy. In fact, we even see it in the days leading up to the seventh day. Every single day, God creates, and then what does he do? He looks. He sees all that he makes. He calls it good and very good. And And we'll talk a little bit about this in my second sermon, but really the Creator God, who practices presence and attention each day of the creation story, continues to do that through the whole biblical narrative. In some ways, it's one of the things that makes God God. It's an essential part of his character. Our Creator is someone who is ever present. In the Christian tradition, we call it omnipresence. Never spaced out, never dozing off when you're talking, never looking at his phone when you're trying to get his attention. You know what I mean? God is ever present. He's a seventh day God. And this is what's really helpful about these poems as we're thinking about what it means to be human in a time when it's hard to be human. In this poem, we are made in the image of this ever-present Creator God. We too are called to create and then be present. After both the humans, what this passage calls earth creatures, that's a more wooden translation of the original word in the Hebrew, the original language of the Old Testament, earth creatures. When both the earth creatures are made, God calls them to do two things. They're given their chief task, and that's to abed and shamar. Those are the original Hebrew words. They're often translated till and keep, abed and shamar. Till and keep is not a bad translation, but I know for me, I often hear those two words, till and keep, and I'm not really sure what to do with them. They seem vague, they seem a little bit hard for me to put into my ordinary life. And Ellen Davis, who's a biblical scholar, suggests that they might not even be the best translations of those two Hebrew words. Those two Hebrew words are very fulsome and they could mean a lot of different things. She suggests that one of the best ways to honor the original Hebrew might be to translate them not till and keep, but rather serve and observe. The first task of the earth creatures that are made in the image of God is to serve and then observe. Do your work, create, be generative, and then step back, look, see, call good, rest, cease. Just like our Creator God. In chapter 1, verse 29, the humans are given all trees and shrubs for harvesting. All of them is yours for food, the passage says. And I bet the first humans heard that. They heard, oh, all of this is ours for food. And what would they have done? They would have pulled out their garden gloves and their hoes and their tills, and they would have started working. They would have gotten harvesting, because that's what they were invited to do. And there was one tree, Creator says, that was in the middle of the land of pleasure, the Garden of Eden, that was not the first humans to eat. It was called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And God said, don't work there. Every plant is yours. And then there's this one plant that is not for working on. It is simply for observation. So there's this whole area for serving and one area for observing. A whole area for being generative and creating, and another section that's just for looking at and seeing as good. And in all these ways, we are image bearers of the God who creates and then rests, the God who labors and then ceases, the God who serves and then observes. This is what it means to be human from the very beginning. And so as we think about this original humanity and the original goodness of humanity, what makes us what we are, what makes us very good, and what leads us into holiness and ever presence, we are given then a roadmap for re-enchantment, a path back to what makes us human in a time where we're so disconnected from what it means to be human at all. And so I want to offer a humble suggestion as you go about your life, your weeks, your years, your decades, as someone living in an age where there aren't very many tools in our toolkit for reconnecting with others, reconnecting with land, reconnecting with God. If you're longing for that reconnection, my humble suggestion to you, based on Genesis 1 and also based on the testimonies from my life and the lives of those I talk to, the roadmap back is very simple. Just start with Sabbath. Start with Sabbath. Sabbath is often in the Christian tradition thought of as taking one day a week off to practice presence with God. One out of every 7 days to be with God, to be with the land, and to be with the ones you love. And although it is a tried and true practice for staying human in a time when it's hard to be human, There is more to it, and I'll get to that, but I also do want to not skip over this as one of the essential anchoring practices for anyone who wants to be human. It's hard to do, and that's why I think we can sometimes gloss past it or gaze over it or get to other parts of what it means to be Christian without mentioning this. It's extremely hard to do. It's hard if you're working multiple jobs. It's hard if you're working shift work. It's hard if you have, you know, entire families that all have different schedules. I get it. I really do. And I think taking one out of every 7 days to be ever present, to seek holy time, to try to be human as best you can, is one of those things that you're not going to regret when you're on your deathbed. You know what I mean? It's one of those things that you're going to thank yourself for when you're coming up to the twilight of your life. Time for the things that make life worth living. One out of every 7 days. And Sabbath can be more than just rest once every 7 days. Sabbath is so much more than that. Sabbath is any moment you give to real observation, to putting aside serving to observe, to really seeing others, seeing land, seeing God for who each of those things really are. That is good and very good. Any moment to be present and to really see is a moment of Sabbath. And a moment when you're reconnecting with what it means to be human. Sabbath is any time for not doing, but simply being. For putting aside our hustle and our bustle. For putting aside our meddling, our worried toil, our anxious action. Which is especially radical and countercultural in our capitalist world. In our economy of never enough. To simply be. And to not do. Sabbath can be any moment of just noticing and accepting what is. Sabbath is looking at all that is around you at the end of every day and noticing what is good, just like the creator did each day. In modern psychology, they're beginning to call this a gratitude practice, and they're suggesting that it's an amazing tool for our toolkit in an age of depression and anxiety. I think that we're all starting to notice, both secular and religious, that there's something about taking a moment to notice what's good. In the creation poems, making time for Sabbath is the first ever instance of something worthy enough of being called holy. It is what sacralizes all of creation. It is at the heart of the vocation given to all image-bearing earth creatures. And in this disenchanted time, I think it's really worth our best shot. A few weeks ago, I was doing a heck of a lot of serving with very little observing, if you know what I mean. I felt like I just couldn't keep up with the avalanche of demands that were on me. My brain was just firing off at a million miles an hour at all times of the day. My shoulders were tense like rocks and my teeth were clenched at all times. And in the midst of my very important life, my sister-in-law had the audacity to invite me to go birding. And my first thought was, who has time for that? And my second, wiser, probably more image-bearing thought was, is there anything else in the world more worthy of my time? Annie Dillard, one of my favorite authors, she has this line where she says, if I seek any sense and skill, any insights in this big city, the information of 1,000 books, I do all of that only, solely, and entirely that I might be able to look well at the creek in my backyard. If I seek any wisdom, any knowledge, any accomplishment, spiritual or material, I do so only that I can be better equipped to give my whole self over to observing a couple of birds. And so I trekked out. And I don't know if you know this. If you don't, I think anyone who follows the way of Jesus should know that May is the best time of the year to see migratory birds. So if you'd like to include any observation in your life, I definitely recommend birding in May. And that week we saw woodpeckers, we saw wrens, we saw a dozen different kinds of warblers and finches. It was a feast for the senses because we saw them. They were bright and beautiful. We heard them. Their songs were gorgeous. And as we drove home, I noticed something. I noticed that my shoulders were loose, that my brow was unfurled, that my jaw was unclenched. I was more human in the best sense of the word than I had been before. And all that I needed to do was look around and say, this is good, very good. Thanks be to God. And that is what the first humans were called to do. We were called to join God in observing all that is around us and calling it good. We were made to take time to put down our toil, our service, our work, and to really see all that is around us and notice God's handiwork in all of it. This is what the creation poems at the start of Scripture are all about. And as we mentioned earlier, God offered us an exercise in non-doing, in simply looking and noticing. And that is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which was the only plant that we were asked to leave be, to merely observe during the harvest season. But you know how the story goes if you're familiar with Genesis 1 and 2. What happened is that we first humans, the first image-bearing earth creatures, overworked. Perhaps we were worried there wouldn't be enough. And we hustled and we toiled at harvest season when we were called to set limits on our service and leave room for observation. We harvested from the tree we were told not to. And we haven't stopped overworking since. We haven't stopped overworking to this day. There are stories all through the remainder of the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures, about God's people meddling where they're not supposed to meddle. Them conquering nations with more zeal than they were entitled to. Of them overworking the soil and leaving the land barren, of them in fact being exiled from the land they were called to serve and observe because they can't figure out how to treat it with the level of respect and reverence that it's due. there's this whole law in place where once every 7 years, the land must lie fallow, where every 49 years, in fact, all people are invited to put aside their toil and even be removed from slavery and brought back to their original land. And yet none of that seemed to happen, certainly not to the degree that it was intended to. And service takes over and observation becomes null and void. And there are prophets over and over again who call the people back to observation when all they're doing is serving. And finally, God sends a archetype person, a best person, a person who's the most human person to ever exist, this God person who image bears God better than any other image-bearing earth creature. And this person calls themselves Lord of the Sabbath. Lord of the Sabbath. We're going to take some time to meditate on this passage in which Jesus, the God-man, calls himself Lord of the Sabbath and reflect together a little about what it means to follow the Lord of the Sabbath in our age and time as New Testament people. Matthew 11, starting at verse 28. Jesus is speaking to a crowd, to his disciples, and he says, "Come to me, all you who labor and carry heavy burdens, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon your shoulders and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble of heart. Here you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." One Sabbath, Jesus walked through the standing grain. The disciples were hungry and began to pick some heads of grain and eat them. When the Pharisees saw this, they said to Jesus, "Look, your disciples are doing something that is forbidden on the Sabbath." Jesus replied, "Have you not read what David did when he and his followers were hungry? How he entered God's house and ate the holy bread, something forbidden to him and his followers or anyone other than the priests? Have you not read in the law how priests, when they are serving in the temple, can break the Sabbath rest without incurring guilt? I tell you, something greater than the temple is here. If you understood the meaning of the text, 'I desire compassion, not sacrifices,' you wouldn't have condemned the innocent. For the chosen one is ruler, Lord of the Sabbath." Amen. So what is happening here? Because it's interesting. I mean, Jesus and his disciples are hungry and they pass a grain field and they pick up the grain and they begin eating it. And this already would seem kind of funny to us in our time, because if we were to find someone eating grain from a random field, our first thought would probably be, "Hey, that's not yours," you know? we don't normally just go to farmers' fields and eat the food. It belongs to the farmers, where we'd be stealing. Right? And so this is a bit of a strange thing to do from our perspective, no matter what day of the week it is, right? But this is actually an interesting thing, because in the Jewish law, in the original kind of the ancient Jewish law, there was something instated that was often called gleaning. It was this practice that all farmers were required to do, where they leave the edges of their fields for people who are hungry to eat freely. It was this opportunity basically to, in many ways, it would be ensuring that whether you own land to farm on in that time or not, there would be food for you to eat at harvest season, because you could go to the edges of any field. Usually it would be about a seventh of every field, and you would be able to eat freely. And that was part of the law. That was something that was always available to you by law. So I'm not sure whether that actually happened or not in the Jewish time. Certainly in the time of Jesus, I'm not really sure. But it was what was written in the law. And the Pharisees, who are law keepers, and we'll get to who they are a little bit later, they would know that. They're scholars of the law. And so they would look at what Jesus is doing, and they should be entirely aware that Jesus and his disciples are actually following the deepest and truest intention of the law by thinking of food and treating food as not a commodity, not something that can be owned or bought or sold, but rather as a gift from the Creator, freely given. And it's the seventh day of the week, what the Jews called Sabbath. And so the Pharisees come up to Jesus and they criticize them. And why are they doing that? Well, the Pharisees were a group of almost kind of religious police officers who would swagger around Israel and Judea, wagging their fingers. Earlier in Jewish history, the Pharisees had taken the original ancient law, the same one that had the gleaning rules, and made additions to include lots of highly restrictive and frankly arbitrary amendments. And one of those includes never harvest on the Sabbath. And so there's kind of this showdown happening here in this passage, a showdown between what you might think of as the letter of the law versus the spirit of the law. Between scarcity and enoughness, between rules and, I guess, grace. Grace. What is grace? Grace is a beautiful word. It's a deeply Christian word. It's a word that could pretty much sum up everything Jesus intended and everything he said and did. It's a word that at its core is basically just a synonym for gift. Gift. Grace is when something is given as a gift. No strings attached. Nothing you can do to deserve it. No need to force it to happen. It just comes to you like a present from a loved one for no particular reason at all. And you can almost picture the Pharisees in that moment with their fists clenched, their jaw tight, their egos growing bigger and bigger at the thought of being right about this. They are in perfect control of their perfectly arranged lives. They are making sure they never misstep from the letter of the law. They seem to treat their religious life as a bunch of tasks to be completed, and they get to tick off every task. The Pharisees, well, I think that what they do is they live in worried toil. And they treat religion as something to hustle towards, to anxiously take action on. And Jesus, well, what's interesting is Jesus in this passage is also following the law in a very different, but an equally, more deeply true way. He sees the spirit of the law. He observes the intention of the law to ensure enough for everything. He observes the intention of the law to make space, to observe, as we talked about last week, to see the world around him, friends, fresh air, grain, the scriptures, the prophets, and even the law, all of it, given as a gift from the Creator. All of it is grace. Jesus evidences time and again that he sees all things as grace, as gift. He quotes the old prophets of the Jewish tradition who writes that God requires mercy, not sacrifice. And what does that mean? It means that God does not require you to clench your fist, to control your life carefully, to follow every rule to a T, even if it sucks away all your enchantment. No. Quite the opposite. God invites all people. He invites you to open your closed fists, to breathe deep the air all around you, to fill your lungs with oxygen, to take and eat and drink freely without price, and to open your eyes wide to the reality that all things are gift. Everything is a gift. Jesus calls himself Lord of the Sabbath, which probably would have really ticked off the Pharisees, who have been functionally attempting in every way to be lords of the Sabbath and every other law. But Jesus means to be Lord of the Sabbath in a very different way from them, of course. He intends not to be a law enforcer of the Sabbath, not a religious police officer here to give you a ticket if he finds you disobeying. No, he intends instead to really take the Sabbath to its fullest end, to sum up everything that was written about Sabbath in the creation poems, in the law, in the Old Testament prophets and stories, and to proclaim that Sabbath in all the synagogues and the streets, to reinvite all people to rest, to observation, to delight, to look at the birds of the air and look at the wildflowers. To offer that rest and healing to all people through his miracles and presence. And finally, Jesus means to be Lord of the Sabbath in the sense that he embodies the reality that all things, even his own body, is not a commodity, but rather a gift. Not something to be owned or grasped, but instead to be given. And he gives his whole life as a grace, as an offering. You don't need to do anything to receive, something that merely comes to you, no strings attached. And just like the grain that just grows on the edges of the field and, according to Jewish law, is just there for you to receive freely if you're hungry, Christ's gift of rest is just there for you to receive freely if you are weary. You don't need to do anything to receive it. Nothing is required because everything is a gift. If you're looking for something to do in order to find rest in our age of worried toil, in our age of disenchantment, in our age of disconnection, in our age of never enough, here is the only thing that you must do. And it's found in his teaching, which essentially is just a poem, just prior to this encounter with the Pharisees. Jesus says, all there is to do is come. Come, he says, all who are weary, all who are struggling, all who are tired. Come, all who are coming home from a long day at work and spending all evening then parenting, all who are waking up at night to feed a baby, all who are waking up at night because you're battling demons whose voices in your head are loud, all who are depressed or anxious, or both, all who are working extra jobs or extra hours because rent is really expensive and so are groceries. All who are working extra jobs because you can't seem to get it in your head that you are enough when you're not doing or accomplishing or producing. All who are caregiving for sick family members. All who are battling climate dread. All who are battling bad landlords. All who are on the front lines of supporting the houseless and the most vulnerable. All who have fists that are clenched and shoulders that are tight. Come, the Lord of the Sabbath says, I'll give you rest. Pick up my yoke and put it on, he says. Take lessons from me. My heart is gentle, Christ says, not arrogant. Come, take on the unforced rhythms of grace, the rhythms of serve and observe, the rhythms of create and then cease, the rhythms of finding rest at the end of a generative day, the rest you deeply need. My yoke is easy to wear, Christ says. My load is easy to bear, because all that load is grace. Amen.